Good evening and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fulilove, the Executive Director of the Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to this conversation with Michael Morell, the former Acting Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. We always strive at the Institute to have speakers who are addressing the topics that are top of the news cycle, but not even we could have planned this, ladies and gentlemen, that just a couple of hours after General Flynn, President Trump's initial national security advisor, resigned 25 days into the job. We are very honoured indeed to host a career intelligence official like Michael Morell. Let me, I'm going to make some a few introductory comments before I introduce Michael. Let me welcome by name Mark Ryan, one of our board members and a number of our supporters and chief executives of our government and corporate members. Let me say that when Michael Morell joined the CIA in 1980, the United States was locked in a bipolar struggle with the Soviet Union. A decade or so after he joined, Moscow conceded defeat and the world switched from a bipolar system to a unipolar system. And the hegemony over the West that was achieved by the United States became the new world order. A liberal international order settled over the earth, or so we thought. Now, a quarter of a century later, the scales have fallen from our eyes. The contests between nation states and ideologies have resumed. Cooperation between great powers is increasing, is declining, I should say, not increasing. Geopolitics have returned, and every day the liberal international order looks less liberal, less international, and less orderly. I'll give you some examples. The decision by the British people to leave the European Union, which I think will result in a distracted Britain, a less liberal Europe, and a weakened West. We've seen a remarkable turnover in leadership in Western countries, and who knows what will happen in the string of elections that Europe will experience this year. We've seen an enormous rise in the forces of populism and a sentiment that elites can no longer be trusted to manage the country and manage the world. And perhaps the most consequential development, of course, was the election of Donald Trump as president. For the first time in history, the leader of the free world is not really interested in leading the world and is not even sure that he believes in the free world. He also has a complicated relationship with the intelligence community. He compared the leaking of the Steele dossier, for example, to Nazi behaviour. He is said not to be a big consumer of the product of the intelligence agencies. He's appointed a political advisor to a permanent seat on the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. And in various tweets, he's appeared to prefer the word of Vladimir Putin, who was arguably one of America's chief adversaries, to the words of his own intelligence officers. So this is a remarkable time for the world and really the best possible time to hear from a person like Michael Morell with three decades of experience at the CIA. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael has served as both the top administrator and the top analyst of the agency. He was, in 2006, he was appointed executive director, and in 2008, he was named director for intelligence. In May 2010, he became deputy director of the agency, and he led the agency on two occasions as acting director. To give you a sense of the way in which Michael worked with presidents of both parties, he was with President Bush on the 11th of September 2011, and he was with President Obama in May 2011 when Osama bin Laden was killed. Last year, for the first time, he endorsed a presidential candidate in a strongly worded op-ed supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy in the New York Times. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Michael Morell. Michael, let's start with the elephant in the room. At 3 o'clock today, General Flynn tendered his resignation as National Security Advisor. He had faced a lot of scrutiny over his discussions on the possibility of lifting American sanctions against Russia with the Russian ambassador to the United States before President Trump took office. And that'll be the FSB on the line. That'll be the FSB on the line. Now, I'll ask everybody to turn off all their listening devices and telephonic devices. So, Michael, General Flynn has resigned. What should we make of this?
So there's a rule in Washington, right, that the cover-up is almost always worse than the sin. So the sin was apparently having a conversation with a Russian ambassador about what U.S. policy might be under a Trump administration, and in particular on a day when the Obama administration imposed sanctions over Russian interference in our election. So that was the sin. I think the cover-up was much worse. The cover-up was apparently lying to the president and to the vice president about the conversation he had, which led the vice president to go out on national television and say, Mike Flynn did not have an inappropriate conversation, did not talk to the Russian ambassador about U.S. policy, about U.S. sanctions. So I think it was that cover-up that ultimately resulted in his resignation. I think he, if he had told the truth right from the beginning about the conversation he had, I think he would have survived.
But is it credible that General Flynn would have been having those sorts of discussions with the Russian ambassador without letting President Trump know?
I think it's quite plausible that he would have those conversations without the president knowing. I think the president is largely a delegator, except on those issues that are important to him. So I could easily see Mike Flynn carrying it out on his own.
So what's next in the National Security Advisor's role? There's some speculation that David Petraeus, who was the Lowy lecturer a couple of years ago, might be in the slot. What does it mean that Mike Flynn that General Flynn has left the office?
So my early assessment of U.S. foreign policy, and we're only a few weeks into this, so that's the big caveat here, right? There's not a lot of data points to work from. But my early assessment is that there were two poles in U.S. foreign policy and a wild card. One pole was Steve Bannon, who you mentioned, is now a member of the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. Steve Miller, who is another close advisor of the president, and Mike Flynn was part of this group, and he no longer is. And that poll is an economic nationalist poll. It is a cultural nationalistic poll where both Bannon and Miller believe that the Judeo-Christian heritage, Judeo-Christian values are under significant threat from not Islamic extremism, but from Islam itself and from China. And Mike Flynn bought into the Islam part. I'm not sure he ever bought into the China part. So that was one poll. And the executive order on immigration came from that poll. The other poll is the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the DNI to be, which is a traditional U.S. national security, slightly right of center poll, which sees not Islam as the threat, but which sees Islamic extremism as the threat. Interestingly, the economic nationalist, cultural nationalistic poll sees Russia as an ally, Christian country, opposed to Islamic extremism, a potential partner against Russia. So in that worldview, Russia fits as an ally. In the traditional national security poll, Russia does not fit as an ally. It fits as an adversary, trying to undermine U.S. influence in the world. So two very different polls. The statements that came out of the U.S. UN ambassador about inappropriate Russian behavior in the last few weeks in eastern Ukraine came from that traditional national security poll. The wild card is the president himself. I think the president himself does not have a deeply held ideology, does not have deeply held policy views. I think if anything, the president's mindset, foreign policy mindset, is isolationist. If there is a direct threat to the United States, we will deal with it, and we will deal with it forcefully. For example, ISIS. Other than that, we should withdraw from the world, and we should take care of our own problems. I think that is, if he has a worldview, that's it. So when there are clashes between the two poles, We may come out sometimes closer to the Bannon Miller view of the world, and in other cases we might come out closer to the Tillerson Mattis view of the world, and in some cases it may be in between. And when an issue is brought to the president, we'll find out which way he leans. I think the departure of Mike Flynn weakens the economic nationalist, cultural nationalistic poll, reduces it by a third, right? And the potential of putting Dave Petraeus in the National Security Advisor's job, I'll come back to that in a second, I think strengthens the traditional national security poll. So I see it. I would see Mike Flynn's departure and Dave Petraeus' arrival as a positive. I worked for David for 18 months. He was the director of CIA. I was the acting director. He is a man of profound capability, experience, knowledge, strategic thinker. I think he will do an exceptional job as National Security Advisor, and I think he will help pull policy toward the more traditional view, which I think is a very good thing.
I want to explore these questions of Mr. Trump's foreign policy and the future direction, but before I get to those sorts of open source issues, I do want to ask you some more questions about the secret world, seeing as you lived in it for 30 years, and for the rest of us, it's quite interesting. There's obviously an enormous amount of speculation about Mr. Trump's views on Russia and how it is that he arrived at them. And many people in this room would have read excerpts of the Steele dossier, for example, that was produced by a former MI6 agent that made certain allegations about compromising information that Russian intelligence services may have on Mr. Trump. Now, when you, in your New York Times op-ed last year, you used a slightly different phrase. That was, of course, before the Steele dossier came to light. You said the following: in the intelligence business, we would say that Mr. Putin had recruited Mr. Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. What did you mean? What is an unwitting agent? And would you still hold by that analysis 6 months later?
So in the intelligence world, there are witting agents. There are people who know that they are doing something on your behalf, and there are unwitting agents. There are people who are doing something on your behalf, and they don't really know they're doing something on your behalf. What I saw early last summer was a former Russian intelligence officer, Vladimir Putin, trained in identifying people's vulnerabilities, trained in taking advantage of those vulnerabilities. I saw Vladimir Putin say some remarkably positive things about Donald Trump. He will be a great leader. He will be a great president. He's been a good businessman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I thought I saw, what I still think I saw, was Vladimir Putin identifying the president's narcissism, the president's ego, and playing to it, and knowing that he would get a positive response. And he did. Donald Trump did not focus on Russia didn't say anything about Russia, didn't say anything about Vladimir Putin until Putin said positive things about him. And then all of a sudden, President Trump is saying all sorts of positive things about Vladimir Putin, is saying things like we shouldn't mind particularly that he took Crimea. I mean, remarkable things from a U.S. policy perspective. So that's what I meant, is that Putin saw the narcissism, played to it, got Trump to respond. That's what I meant by unwitting agent.
When you... I presume you had a chance to read the Steele dossier. Yes. What did it look like? I mean, you've got decades of experience of reading reports from CIA. What did that dossier feel like? Did it feel like it had the ring of truth about it?
So I read it three times. I'm obviously interested in this subject. I read it three times. And I felt like I was reading CIA human intelligence reports. That's what I felt like I was reading that again. Which means that you're reading things that sound, some things that resonate as possibly true, and you're reading some things that you say to yourself, that can't be true. But the bottom line of reading it, and the same is true of CIA human intelligence reports, is you don't know what's true, and you don't know what's not true. You don't have a sense of what's credible and what's not credible unless you know who the sources are, at least by position, if not by name, and how that particular source got a particular piece of information. So, for example, was Steele with regard to a particular piece of information talking to a current Russian government official or a former Russian government official? Big difference with regard to credibility in my mind, right? And then even if you have a current Russian government official who was talking to Steele, how did that person get a particular piece of information? Did they see a document in which I would say that's highly credible? Or did they hear it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend in which I'd say that's not credible at all? So unless you know those two things, you can't make anything out of the dossier. And so to this day, I can't tell you it's true. I can't tell you part of it's true. I can't tell you it's all false or even part of it's false. Just don't know.
One of the explosive allegations in the dossier was that the FSB had some sort of compromising intelligence on Mr. Trump. Now, you've just said then that you can't make a judgment whether that's true or not. But would it be normal practice, do you think, for FSB to monitor and to surveil someone like Mr. Trump if he were traveling to Moscow?
Yes, it would be common practice for them to monitor any person of significance from the West.
Let me ask you about some reports we've had recently about how the U.S. intelligence community is reacting to Mr. Trump's election. First of all, there was a story a few weeks ago that U.S. intelligence officers had advised their Israeli counterparts not to share intelligence with the United States once Mr. Trump was in office, which is obviously a very strong allegation if it's true. What did you make of that?
So one of the things you learn from being in the CIA for 33 years is that the media stories that you read about the organization and about intelligence have a batting average of about 50-50 when it comes to getting the facts right. This is a fact that does not sound right to me. You know, I believe that intelligence officers are first and foremost professionals who will serve whoever is the commander-in-chief. And I do not believe that any of the intelligence officers that I ever worked for would do anything to undermine the national security of the United States. And one way you would do that is by telling a foreign ally, don't share information with me. So I don't believe that.
Another story, the second story that just came out in the last couple of days, was written, I think, by a former NSA analyst. And this person said that NSA and other intelligence agencies were keeping secrets from the White House due to security concerns. I think the quote was, they don't want to pass the good stuff up to the White House. And there was, the story contained a quote from an unnamed senior Pentagon intelligence official who said that since January the 20th, the date that Mr. Trump was inaugurated as president, we've assumed that the Kremlin has ears inside the Situation Room. What do you think about that?
That seemed to me to be significantly overstated. You know, whenever I read something, so this was a former NSA analyst who wrote this. So as I read it, I tried to see, how does this person know what he says he knows, right? And I didn't see anything in that article that gave me any sense that he was talking to individuals who would actually know the content of those allegations. Again, I don't believe that the intelligence community is withholding information from the president. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I find it highly, highly, highly unlikely that anybody in the U.S. government believes that the Russians have listening devices in the Situation Room.
All right, let me ask you about a controversy that has arisen in the last 24 hours ago concerning the North Korean missile test.
Yes.
2 days ago, North Korea conducted a missile test launch. The test coincided with the visit of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan to the United States. And Mr. Trump was hosting Prime Minister Abe at the Mar-a-Lago Club. And the story appeared to break, actually, when they were having dinner in the public dining room of the Mar-a-Lago Club in the presence of various individuals who'd paid, I think, a $200,000 joining fee to join Mr. Trump's club. And there's been a lot of speculation, there were social media posts from individuals who were at the club who had photographs of Mr. Trump and his aides, including Mr. Bannon and General Flynn, appearing to look at classified documents, actually using the torches on their phones to read those documents. And I think I saw also a photograph that somebody had taken with the military aide responsible for the nuclear codes. Now, obviously, this is not what we're used to seeing. Ordinarily, presidents confer, we presume, with people like you in behind closed doors, and then the president comes out in the East Room and he makes an announcement. It's quite different for this all to be happening in public. So what did you make of this spectacle?
Transparency taken too far? Look, if I were General Flynn, I would have dragged the president to a private room to look at the materials, to have possibly classified conversations on the phone and with his top aides. I wouldn't have given him a choice. So that was the reaction to the making policy right in front of everybody. I think there's a security issue there. People could overhear what was being said. I think the issue of the young military officer taking pictures with guests, I think that young officer simply needs some counseling. It's less of a security issue and more of it trivializes the absolute significance of what that young man's job is, which is to carry nuclear codes that could launch U.S. nuclear weapons, right? So he just needs a good counseling session.
One of the aides who was caught on those photographs conferring with President Trump was, of course, Steve Bannon. We mentioned him earlier. One of my colleagues, Aaron Connolly, was recalled recently, I think, that Sandy Berger, for whom Aaron once worked in the Clinton White House, had fought a big battle to keep George Stephanopoulos out of some of those meetings of the NSC. One of the things that at the Institute we are trying to do is to really to look through the noise and see the signal with some of these moves by President Trump and work out what is genuinely unprecedented and what is new versus what is what is something he's doing that's a bit unusual and his critics don't like. So how would you interpret the kind of role that you mentioned in your opening remarks Steve Bannon is having in the conduct of foreign and national security policy so far? Is this unprecedented? And is it undesirable? Is it something that we should be anxious about, that we have a political advisor, and especially one who holds some of the views that you mentioned, in these inner councils? Or actually, should we chill out about this development?
My view is that politics is not welcome in the room, ever. In my experience, politics has never been in the room except once. We can talk about that if you want. But in my experience, politics is not there. Politics is not welcome. Political people are not welcome. And so I believe it is highly inappropriate for Steve Bannon to be a permanent member of the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. I have no idea what the president was thinking when he appointed him, when he signed off on whatever order it was. It was another situation where I think Mike Flynn should have taken a leadership role and said, "No, Mr. President, that's not how we do things." I think Jim Mattis and Rex Tillerson should have done the same thing. So I don't see it as appropriate, and I actually see it as dangerous, because you don't want politics to be influencing national security policy in any way.
I think I will have to ask you about that one occasion when politics entered the Situation Room, or the audience.
It was a debate over the Bin Laden raid, right? Whether we should go in on circumstantial evidence. What was, at the end of the day, the president would tell you it was a 50-50 case that whether Bin Laden was there or not at this compound in Abbottabad. And one of the participants, that I will keep from you, one of the participants made the argument that if the American people knew what we know and we don't act, they would have our heads. So that was a political argument, It was a political argument. It was the first time I'd ever heard a political argument in the sit room.
And how was it resolved?
Well, you know how it resolved. We went in and got him.
All right. Let me. We're having so much fun in the secret world. We may stay there for a little bit longer. I'm going to give in about 5 or 10 minutes. I'm going to go to the audience. So please start to think of questions that you'd like to ask Michael. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask a few more about the intelligence world. Let me ask you about the issue of enhanced interrogation techniques, or to use a more loaded term about some of them, torture. There's a lot of speculation about this issue because President Trump has said that he personally favours waterboarding, for example. And we all saw the press conference where he said that he's appointed a Secretary of Defence who doesn't believe in waterboarding and he will defer to Secretary Mattis. I guess it must be said that's now when the United States is not facing a ticking time bomb or a national security crisis. So can I ask you, how do you think the intelligence services in the United States would react if the Trump administration asked them to re-up some of these enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding?
So at the time, right, we're going way back to 9/11 here. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when the context was that it felt like a ticking time bomb, when we felt with quite a bit of justification that Al-Qaeda was going to hit us again, and when we were capturing very senior Al-Qaeda operatives who we believed to have information about these attacks, that the CIA, under the direction of President Bush and the approval of the Attorney General and the approval of the rest of the National Security Team, undertook a series of interrogation techniques called enhanced interrogation techniques in order to get information out of these individuals about potential attacks against the United States. At the time those were done, they were deemed to be legal under both U.S. treaty obligations and under U.S. law. The Attorney General said they were legal on multiple occasions. So they weren't torture. Torture it doesn't matter what you think is torture, doesn't matter what I think is torture, doesn't matter what each of us as individuals think is torture. It matters what the courts think. It matters how it relates to what the law says. So subsequent to those activities, Congress passed a number of laws, and some of those techniques are now illegal. Some of those techniques are now considered torture under U.S. law. Waterboarding is the best example. Waterboarding, prior to this legislation, not torture, legal. Post-legislation, now considered torture, illegal. So if the president were to ask the U.S. military or the Central Intelligence Agency to undertake these activities, the ones that are deemed to be illegal, any CIA officer, the CIA director would say, no, Mr. President, it's illegal. I will not do that. If it's legal, if something is legal and the military or the CIA is asked to do it, then you really have two choices. You've got a choice to salute and carry out the legal directive of the commander-in-chief, or you step down and let somebody else take your place. So that legal question is absolutely vital here.
What would you answer if President Trump looked at you as he did it to General Mattis and said, what do you think about waterboarding, Michael? Do you think we should be using this?
And I'd say, no, it's illegal, Mr. President. And I would also explain that the context of the times of 2002, 2003 was extraordinarily unique, sui generis. It's hard to imagine we would face something like that again. And most importantly, I would say to him that we were asked to do this. We did it, and we were left to hang out to dry. There were investigations of the CIA for carrying out its the duties given to it by the president and told by the Attorney General that they were legal. There were officers who were put through legal hell. And so I would say to him, I don't want to do anything like this again, even if it's legal, because the political landscape is going to shift and my office, and I don't want my officers being hung out there to dry.
And what about the question of the effectiveness of those techniques?
So it's a really good question. So the Senate Intelligence Committee, during my last year as deputy director, did its own study of the enhanced interrogation program. One of the conclusions they came to is that these techniques were not effective. We were asked by the committee to comment. And by the way, this was the Democratic half of the committee. The Republicans did not participate in this study. So it was a partisan study. It was not bipartisan. We were asked to provide comments on the study. And I was deeply involved in making sure that our response was one that we could stand behind. And so I studied this quite a bit in the last year that I was deputy director. And one of the things I looked at was a chart that showed the information provided by these detainees prior to enhanced interrogation techniques and the information provided by them post-enhanced interrogation techniques. No information was elicited during the enhanced interrogation techniques. That's not what was done. This was to condition people to believe that they had resisted to the point where they were now permitted to provide us information. So it's really interesting when you look at information provided before and information provided after. Before, what you see is not full answers to questions. You see vague answers, non-specific, non-actionable. Post-enhanced interrogation techniques, you see full answers to questions. You see specific information. You see actionable information. I'll give you a very specific example. One individual, before enhanced interrogation techniques, tells us that Al-Qaeda in Pakistan has moved to a particular city. So it appears specific, but in fact it's not actionable. Post-enhanced interrogation techniques, he looks at satellite imagery and says they're here, they're here, they're here, and they're here, making that information actionable to the Pakistanis. So big difference, in my view, pre and post. Now, whether you could have gotten that information in another way is an entire another question. And whether this was the right thing to do or not is a completely different question, right? I mean, there's a question of legality, right? There's a question of effectiveness. There's a question of necessary. Of necessity. And then there's a question of morality. And there's two ways to look at the morality question. And my bottom line, by the way, on this is, as I haven't found a single person who I believe, if they had been put in President Bush's shoes, I haven't found a single person who I can tell you that I know what they would have done. So on the morality question, there's two ways to look at it. One way is, how can the United States of America, which stands for human rights, human dignity, in the world, how could the United States of America do those things to another individual? That's one half of the morality coin. Now flip it over, right? The other half of the morality coin is, if you really believe that this person has information that they're not sharing with you, that if they shared it with you could save lives by stopping a terrorist attack, how do you not do those things? So President Bush was put in an extremely difficult position, and I wouldn't want to have to make that decision.
Let me ask you two more questions about intelligence matters, and then we'll go to questions, and I'll try to come back to some of these broader foreign policy questions then. The first relates to the Five Eyes intelligence network that emerged from the Second World War of the United States, and the UK, and Canada, and Australia, and New Zealand. This is an issue, this is a subject that occasionally comes up in Australia. It's obviously connected to our alliance with the United States, but also slightly distinct from it. policymakers and analysts who have access to that, to the information they gain from the Five Eyes network, will often say it's very valuable in helping them to make sense of the world. What's your observation as somebody who's been in the middle of it, the biggest poll of Five Eyes? How powerful is it as an analytical network? How useful is it both to the United States and to the extent that you can judge to Australia as well?
So the issues, the national security issues that we face today and that we've faced since, I think, the end of the Cold War, are ones of great complexity. And I don't believe it's possible for any single intelligence agency to successfully do its job on those issues without a significant partnership within their country, between intelligence agencies within a country, and between intelligence agencies across the world. So one of my major jobs as the deputy director of CIA was to maintain, build, enhance those relationships. And people came to see me, and I went to see other people. The most important by far partnerships are among the Five Eyes. There are three ways that intelligence agencies can cooperate. One is by sharing what they think about issues, sharing analysis. So you sit down and say, here's what we think about Iran. What do you think about Iran? And you look where there are differences. It's not interesting to talk about where you agree. It's really interesting to talk about where you disagree and why. And you can by talking about where you disagree on analysis, you can create new knowledge. You can create new insight. So one is sharing analysis and talking about it. Another is sharing intelligence information. There's two ways to do that. One is orally. You simply brief them. And the other is by actually passing paper. So that gets done. Right? The more trust there is, the more you move from oral to paper. And then third is actually working together to collect information, working together operationally to collect information that is of relevance to the issues that both of you are working on. And there are some intelligence services in the world where we only do one. There are some intelligence services in the world where we do two, and there are some where we do three, and the Five Eyes is a great example of where we do all three.
All right, my last question concerns the question of how free societies can defend themselves from foreign interference. Obviously, we know, well, there's been an enormous debate that everybody in the room is aware of about the Russian attempts to interfere in your presidential election. So let me ask you two questions. First of all, what do you make of that story? How consequential, how effective were those attempts to interfere with the presidential election, in which you had a stake as somebody, not only as an American, but somebody who was actively, who had endorsed one of those candidates for president? And secondly, at the broader level, what can countries like the United States and Australia do to better protect ourselves from that kind of foreign interference?
It's a great question. So I think the Russians did, and this is the public view of the U.S. intelligence community, right? There's a declassified report which you can go to the internet and you can read. The Russians did three things. Number one, the Russians used cyber espionage to steal information and then give that information to organizations to put in the public domain information that was damaging to Secretary Clinton. That's the commonly known one, right? But they did two other things as well. One of the other things they did was to both create fake news and then to amplify that fake news through social media. That may, at the end of the day, have been more effective in altering the outcome of the election than stealing the information from the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta and putting it in the public domain. And then the third thing they did is they attempted to access voting machines via cyber with the intent of playing with the tally. Now, they weren't successful. They weren't successful because for the vast majority of these voting machines were not connected to the internet. and the ones that were properly defended. So they did three different things. I don't think you can overstate the significance of this. And I don't think it's gotten enough attention in my own country. This is a major power in the world trying to influence the outcome of an election in another major power. I think the sanctions that were, I think the largely sanctions, but a couple of other steps that the Obama administration took were, in my view, weak. In my view, did not force Putin to pay a high enough price. In terms of your question about the ultimate effectiveness, we'll never know. We'll never know. But when you lose by 70,000 votes in three states, pretty much everything you did matters, right? Pretty much everything you did is potentially dispositive. So there's an argument you can make here that the Russians did indeed influence the outcome of the election. But as I said, we'll never know for sure. But in terms of going forward, I was and remain a supporter of a presidential commission to look into this. This is something that has bipartisan support among a small number of senators and congressmen. The commission would do two things. The commission would look at exactly what happened here. Exactly what did the Russians do? What I described to you is what we know they did. That's the piece of the iceberg above the water. What did they do that we didn't see? What more digging do we need to do? What more intelligence collection do we need to do to figure this out, right? So one is exactly what did they do and how did they do it? And two is, how do we prevent it from happening again in two respects? One is, how do we better defend ourselves, right? Both in terms of cybersecurity and what do we do about this social media problem we have with the ability of a nation state or even a well-resourced organization to amplify news, right, by pushing out hundreds of thousands of social media posts. So how do we better defend ourselves against that? And then how do we create deterrence with regard from somebody trying to do this to us? So how do we deter Russia from ever doing this again? Right? Those are the two fundamental questions that need to be asked and answered, and I'm concerned that neither one of them is going to be addressed.
Terrific. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to give you an opportunity to ask some questions. I'll start over here with Deborah Snow.
Thanks very much. That was absolutely fascinating. Deborah Snow from the Fairfax Media Organisation. Michael, I'm just wondering whether you see the Trump presidency lasting the whole 4 years, given the rocky progress over the last 3 to 4 weeks. Second question, how do you think Australia's intelligence agencies should be deciding how they interface with the US intelligence community in the wake of what we've seen in the last, the turbulence in the last few weeks? And thirdly, is it correct to see the intelligence community as effectively at war in a way with the administration, or is that something that's going to blow over? If it is at war, how will that play out?
Yeah. On the first one, I don't know, right? I don't know. I think if there is to be an issue, it's going to be an issue between the administration and the courts. It's going to be some constitutional crisis created by lack of respect, right? Lack of restraint that courts put on the administration. I think if it comes to an end early, that would be the reason why. But I'm not sure I would bet if on this, because I just don't know. The second issue was Australia.
The Australian intelligence community should reconsider its interface. Yeah.
What gets shared with a president is kind of the analytic bottom lines, right? So what are the capabilities of North Korea's missiles? That's the kind of thing that gets shared with the president. Right? The president doesn't need to know and does not get told how we know that, right? What the specific sources of information are. If they were to ask, they'd be told. But they generally don't ask because it doesn't matter to them, how we know something, whether we collected it ourselves, how we collected it, or whether it was given to us by a foreign government. So my strong recommendation to all of our allies would be that there is no reason here for our relationship to change. On the third question, I think it's largely blown over. One of the things that an intelligence officer is supposed to do is to give the other guy's perspective, to tell the president how the other guy is thinking about an issue, right? So we just talked about what Vladimir Putin did to the United States of America and to our election. Well, it doesn't excuse his behavior, but it's important to know that he actually believes that we mess around in his politics. He really believes that. He's wrong, we don't, but he fundamentally believes that we are trying to undermine him and his regime, right? So it's really important to look at the other guy's perspective, right? So I don't want to say struggle between the intelligence community and Trump, because that's the wrong way to characterize it, but in this...
I
don't think that's fair either. But I do think it's interesting to look at Trump's perspective, and I've been thinking about this a little bit. So let's look at this from Trump's perspective. So what does he see? During the campaign, he saw a former director, Mike Hayden, strongly criticize him. He saw a former deputy director and acting director strongly criticize him and actually endorsed Secretary Clinton. So there must have been a moment in his mind where he said, who are these CIA guys? Right? And then he saw 24 to 48 hours after his first intelligence briefing, when he became the Republican presidential candidate and he got his first intelligence briefing, he saw a leak. He saw leaks from that briefing that were critical of him and his national security advisor. Right? So he says again to himself, what is it with these guys? And then within a few days after becoming the president-elect, he sees leaks about him putting off his intelligence briefings. So again, right, there's reason to question, are these guys political? These CIA guys, are they political? So I think he ended up connecting the dots in a wrong way, right? What Mike Hayden and Mike Morrell said about him during the campaigns got nothing to do with the Central Intelligence Agency. So I think he thought that the intelligence community and CIA were political. I think it was, it was a wrong conclusion, but I can understand how he got there. And it doesn't excuse him criticizing the intelligence community the way he did. But it does give you a different perspective to think about that way.
Just following on from that point a bit, Rob Thomas, I'd like to understand, America is potentially moving to be more isolationist, focusing probably more on Islam. Do you see any change in focus for the CIA going forward? And given some of the comments from Mr. Trump, do you see any impact on the morale of the CIA going forward and any impacts that could have going forward?
Yeah, so in terms of the focus of the agency, presidents don't have a huge impact on that. The focus of the agency tends to be the key national security issues that are facing the country. Those don't change from one president to another. Presidents can certainly say, hey, I'm much more interested in the environment than my predecessor, and I want you to do a lot more work on analytic work on climate change or the environment, right? So that happens, but in terms of collection, intelligence collection, it's pretty constant from administration to administration. And then your second question was? Oh, yeah, so morale. Look, when the president-elect criticized the intelligence community, when he criticized CIA, when he went to CIA, the second day he was president, and he didn't handle himself particularly well in the lobby of our building in front of stars that are there to commemorate the deaths of people who died in the line of duty, right? When that didn't go particularly well, I think people were their morale took a hit. Mike Pompeo, who is the new director, I think is a very good person. I think he understands the mission of the agency. I think he understands that its fundamental purpose is to put facts on the table and to speak truth to power. And I think he's going to do that. I think that has helped. I think Mike's arrival at the agency has helped tremendously. But I think at the end of the day, the morale is going to depend on the extent to which agency officers think that the president is listening to what they have to say. And not only the president, but the president and the National Security Advisor, the two most important people. And if there's a perception that the president is listening, and listening with an open mind, even though he may not agree with everything they say, they'll be okay. But if there's a perception that he's not listening, and he's cherry-picking facts to support his view of the world, I think morale will take a real hit, and I think people will start to leave. And I think it'll be a significant loss for the nation. So I think it's yet to be determined.
Ralph Evans, no affiliation these days. This is a question maybe as much political as to do with intelligence. President Trump has changed his view 180 degrees in recent weeks on the One China policy. I'm puzzled by how that might have happened and what process might have influenced it.
Yeah. So I think that, and I don't know, right? I'm not part of this. Believe me, I'm not part of this inner circle, right?
We gather that.
I'm not even on the fringes of the circles. I think that nobody thought through the call from the Taiwanese president. I think it just happened. I think she called. He took the call. Nobody said, hey, wait a second, Mr. President. Do you know that a U.S. president and a president of Taiwan haven't talked in, 40 years? So I think that just happened. It wasn't planned. It wasn't a strategic move to try to put the Chinese on the defensive. I just think it happened. Then I thought there was a quick move to try to defend the president, to try to make it look like it was thoughtful and strategic. That's what White Houses do. That's what the political part of White Houses do, as you know. Then I think what happened was Xi Jinping played it brilliantly. He said, I'm not going to talk to you until you're willing to acknowledge the One China policy. And it was starting to get a little uncomfortable. And finally, I think the traditional national security poll that I talked about of Tillerson and Mattis, you have to have a relationship here with the Chinese. This relationship is vital, right, to the future of both of our countries and future to the stability of East Asia. So you need to have a relationship here, and we got to fix this. And fixing it means when you talk to him, you have to acknowledge the One China policy. I would bet that's the way it played out.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, Michael, where do you think Trump's policy on China will end up? Because obviously he started off in a very forward-leaning way with the phone call, with the tweets. There's a lot of people around him who, as you say, are very anti-China. He's got this Peter Navarro as the head of the National Trade Council and so on. But there's another side of me as an analyst that thinks that that the Chinese will be trying to strike a deal with Trump to protect their interests, and he's a deal maker. And in the end, what does Trump care about some half-submerged water features in the South China Sea, or for that matter, arguably, various alliances in Asia, if they give him what he wants, which helps him politically on economics and trade and so on. There's a third course, of course, that he could strike, which would be carefully balancing elements of competition with elements of cooperation and punishing them for bad behaviour and cooperating them with them when it makes sense. But it's hard to look at the developments in the last few hours and have a lot of confidence that he would be able to strike that devilishly difficult balance. But when you sort of squint your eyes, where do you guess that someone like Donald Trump would come down on in a couple of years on China?
So the Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, poll is all about economic nationalism, right, when it comes to China. And it's about doing something for the base that elected him, right? These manufacturing workers who lost their jobs, quite frankly, not because of trade with China, but because of automation. But that's lost in the facts are lost here in the politics of this. That's their focus. I think the president probably feels he has to do something. He has to be seen, right, as making progress. He has to be able to stand up and say he has a new trade deal with China. whether it changes the fundamentals or not, right? I think that's less important, quite frankly, as being able to say it. I think the other poll, right, is much more focused on China as a strategic power and the U.S. relationship with it, and how we manage that in a way that leads to more stability rather than less stability, which I believe is the critical issue facing U.S. foreign policy for the next 25 years, is that relationship. So the Tillersons and the Mattises and the Pompeos and the Dave Petraeuses will understand that. And there'll be a struggle between the Bannons and the Millers and the Tillersons and the Petraeuses and the Mattises. And the president will want to be able to say that I delivered on trade. How that dynamic all works together, I don't know how it comes out, but I would agree with you 100% that I think the Chinese are hoping there's a deal to be had here, right? Let him, you know, do something that allows him to stand up and say, we have a new relationship with China on trade. Here's what it looks like. Here's how it's different. And turning a blind eye to more Chinese, more strategic Chinese interests. That's probably China's calculation.
I'm going to ask the last question as well. I'm sorry to disappoint. There are a few other hands in the air, but we always finish events on time here at the Institute. And I do want to finish by asking you for some advice, asking you to give some advice, not to the President of the United States, but to the Prime Minister of Australia. Obviously, Mr. Turnbull is charged with managing this alliance and therefore this personal relationship with President Trump. And it didn't get off to a great start. It turns out that Mr. Trump has a poor telephone manner. I don't know if you heard that. And they had a very difficult relationship, a very difficult call. Mr. Turnbull really elevated this particular issue that was politically important to him, the deal, the refugee deal. But, of course, that really aggravated Mr. Trump because politically he felt that would hurt him. We've seen other leaders take all sorts of different approaches. You've seen Angela Merkel on the one hand being pretty forward-leaning in terms of asserting German values and recognising that or really alluding to differences between German values and some of the things Mr. Trump is saying. On the other hand, on the other side of the spectrum, you had Theresa May who raced to Washington, who had that press conference, was photographed holding the president's hand and invited him on a state visit, including a visit to Buckingham Palace. So all over the world, leaders are trying to grapple with this question, this very unusual interlocutor. What would be your advice to Prime Minister Turnbull? What do you think is the, I mean, you're, as a CIA analyst, you're used to dealing with individuals and reading them. As you read President Trump, what's the best way for Prime Minister Turnbull to manage the alliance, to promote Australia's interests in those alliance, in that alliance, but at the same time not get perhaps sucked into situations that he doesn't want to do? So how do you think he should manage that relationship?
So it's a great question, right? It's kind of the fundamental question for all of our allies, right? First thing I'd say is I would much rather have had the president have a bad conversation with your prime minister than have a bad conversation with Xi Jinping, right? It's better to have a fight with a friend than a fight with an enemy, right? I really believe that. So good that it happened with a friend rather than not a friend. The consequences could have been much worse, right? So that's the first point. The second point is, There is a way to play to him. There is a way to play to him, right? There is a way to get on his good side, which is to tell him how wonderful he is. And you know, some people have figured that out. Vladimir Putin was the first one. So I would try to build a personal relationship the best way I knew how, and that would be part of my calculation if I were a foreign leader. I would tend in this administration to push substance down, right, to a level where you know it's going to get a proper hearing. So I'm not sure if I were if I were the leader of an ally that I would talk substance. I would raise an issue like that with him. You know, I might have leave it to my foreign minister to talk to the Secretary of State, or leave it to my national security advisor to talk to Dave Petraeus. I'm not sure I'd have him talk to Mike Flynn, but you know, if it's Dave Petraeus, I'd do that. And I think the other thing I would do is, I think that our allies can be an influential pole in this struggle that's going to take place in our national security between those two poles I talked about. I think our allies can be an influence to pull the U.S. in the right direction, and I would strongly encourage them to do that. And you know, in Australia's case, it's not only talking about the immense value of this relationship to both countries, but the threats that both of us face here in East Asia and the best way to manage them.
Well, I think that's very useful advice, because to Deborah Snow's first question about whether Mr. Trump might be impeached or leave office early, of course, it's very hard to remove a president before his term is up. And it's been a long time since a president has been impeached and convicted. And I was reminded the other day that four out of the last five presidents served two terms. So mathematically speaking, there's probably a greater chance that Mr. Trump serves two full terms than that he serves less than one term. So therefore, getting that kind of advice for the Prime Minister is very useful. And also hearing more generally from our perspective, I think hearing from somebody like Michael with the depth of his experience, who's prepared to speak frankly on such a broad range of issues, is incredibly valuable. I think it was James Jesus Angleton who referred to the intelligence world as the wilderness of mirrors, if I'm right. And we've had a terrific guide this evening to lead us through that wilderness of mirrors. So please join me in thanking Michael Morrell.